You're listening to the Zandbergen Report, where wealth strategies and investment wisdom collide with Bart Zandbergen, your distinguished host and certified financial planner.
Welcome to the Zandbergen Report, a showcase for wealth strategies and investment wisdom that's essential for our evolving world. I'm your host, Bart Zandbergen. Paul, it seems like it was just yesterday that I've seen you. How are you?
Just yesterday. Well, I'll tell you what, it's a small world. We're talking about some of your friends were in here last week, and you're going to be a guest on another show. We're just not going to get rid of you anymore here.
You know, it's the Bart tribe, I guess.
I think it is. And you must have a big tribe, because everywhere I go, I tell people about, hey, we got this new show, Bart Zandbergen. And they go, oh, Bart, I know Bart. I'm like, does everybody know Bart but me here?
Well, I really enjoyed last week's show. I think that Q&A went really well. And
Love it.
Yeah.
Got a lot of response to it, and I hope we get more people writing in, because I think that's what these shows can do. Talk to the unspoken fears that we all have. You all give me these positive things, and I say, oh, yeah, I'm going to do it. And I'm saying, am I the only one not doing any of this stuff here?
That's right. So we developed actually even a new email address for the show, and it's podcast@bartzandbergen.com. So, listeners, if you have some questions either this week or the upcoming weeks, make sure you use that email. We'll be happy to get to
it. And let's make sure we keep spelling Zandbergen, because we had somebody else last week say, how do we spell this show again? It's up on the screen and everywhere else, but we should always, whenever we mention that, we should spell that out, too.
All right, so I'll start with the hard one, Bart, B-A-R-T.
Oh, you've heard this before, okay.
Z as in zebra, A-N-D, B as in boy, E-R-G-E-N.com. So, also in studio today, I'm very happy and proud to have Dan Lively. He's both a CPA and a tax attorney. His firm is the Lively Law Group. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bart. Good to be here.
Thank you, thank you. So, Dan, before we get into it, you mind telling the listeners a little bit about yourself, your background?
Sure. As you said, Bart, I'm both a CPA and a tax attorney. I'm also certified by the State Bar of California as a certified tax specialist. What makes that interesting is there's only about 400 of us in California. And we specify different tax issues for our clients. And I also teach at Whittier Law School. I've taught there for 5 or 6 years, and I've been the director of tax on the state bar.
All right, so classic underachiever. All right, Dan, well, thanks for sharing that. All right, so both as a CPA and a tax attorney, most people know what CPAs do. I'm not sure if everyone knows what a tax attorney does. Can you explain maybe some of the things that kind of fall under that umbrella?
Yeah, interesting question, Bart. And actually, I remember when I was in college, and we went around the room. I was in a communications class, and they asked me what a CPA was, and I got stumped.
Once I retract my assumption. Tell what a CPA is as well.
We do a lot of the same things. There are some things that a CPA can do that a tax attorney can't, and there's some things that a tax attorney can do that a CPA can't. For instance, CPAs do financial statements and audited financial statements. That's something that only they can do. Attorneys can represent you in court. CPAs cannot. One of the things that's interesting about our firm is that we do both. We do CPA style work, which may be tax preparation and tax planning. We also do tax attorney work, which would include tax planning as well, maybe more in depth and more analysis with case law. And we also can represent our clients if they have issues with either the IRS or the Franchise Tax Board or any other taxing agencies.
Okay, great. That really helps. All right. So a number of things I want to ask you today. We all know that in December of last year, there was some significant tax law changes. One specifically had to do with pass-through entities.
Correct.
I think it's, for most people, it's pretty confusing, and then it gets even more confusing because there's some exclusions or exemptions within the pass-throughs. Can you try, on the best of your knowledge, explaining to people what that is and how that might apply to them?
Correct. Just so that everybody knows, we had a new tax law that came into effect January 1st of 2018, and that's called H.R. 1, and we have... Probably you've asked the question about probably the most complex end of that that whole tax law. Some of the things that people are aware of right now would be, for instance, the limitation on the SALT deduction, which really affects us here in California. That's the state and local income taxes, and that would include our property taxes, our state taxes, SDI, things that we're normally used to deducting here. And for high wage earners or people that own substantial amounts of property, that is limited to $10,000 now. What people may not understand is that's also not limiting if you have rental property or your business. We also have limitations on our interest now, where they capped it at $750,000 rather than the $1 million that we previously had, and we also do not have the second home mortgage that's deductible anymore. But more specifically to your question with this deduction for the pass-through entities, one of the things that happened with the new tax act was that they reduced corporate tax rates down to 21%. And to try and equalize corporations with pass-through entities, Congress came up with, let's give a 20% deduction to pass-through entities so that we can pass that income on to their Form 1040s, where they normally get taxed on that at their individual income tax rates. But now we're going to give them this 20% deduction that equalizes it more with corporations. And as you stated, there are some confusions with this, partly because there are limitations and hurdles that we have to cross in order to get that 20%. There are two specific hurdles that we have to be aware of. The first one is this hurdle with specified service businesses. If you're a specified service business, there are specific limitations as to who can take this deduction or not. And interestingly enough, Congress carved out architects and engineers, which means they aren't subject to this exclusion. But if you're a doctor, a lawyer, stockbroker, financial planner, any kind of consultant, service type professional, this is something that you have to be concerned about. And it has income limitations, taxable income. So if we have a taxable income on a joint return that's $315,000 or less than that, I should say, or an individual that's $157,500, we're in the clear. We get the 20% deduction. It's when we start crossing over that threshold that we have a problem. There's an actual cliff with the specified service professional. If they get over a certain amount, and that amount is $415,000 on a joint, or half of that, $207,500 on an individual return, then there's absolutely no deduction for the specified service professional. In between those two numbers, there's a proration reduction. That's the first hurdle that we have to worry about. The second one is what we call a wage and capital limit. And that applies to these other businesses, which we'll call qualified trades or business. If they are not a service business, they meet that hurdle, and now they're going over into this wage and capital limit, we have to look at two things. One is we have to look at their W-2 wages. If 50%, we take a number 50% of their W-2 wages, and we compare that to 25% of their W-2 wages plus 2.5% of their depreciable assets, mm-hmm. whichever one's greater, we take that, and that's their limitation. So that gives us a lot of calculations that we have to do to see if somebody qualifies. First, if somebody, again, is under this $315,000 limit as a joint return, or $157,500 as an individual return, they have no concerns. They're going to get the full deduction. It's when we get over the $415,000 number for a joint, $207,500 for an individual, that we have to start getting really concerned about, are we on the cliff with a specified, or are we on this wage and capital limitation if we're a qualified trade or business?
So just to clarify and to take a break here for a sec, so is it total income or just W-2? So if it's an S-corp, perhaps there's a W-2 income of, I'm going to make up some numbers, so maybe it's a W-2 income of $150,000 and then K-1 or pass-through income of $400,000. So how does that work in your formula?
Yeah, there's some clarity that isn't available yet, just because the IRS, when a tax law comes out, it gets passed on to the U.S. Treasury, and the Treasury writes regulations, and we don't really have those yet. But from what we can see, they call it qualified taxable income that we're talking about. And qualified taxable income is the taxable income taking out the compensation and taking out investment income.
All right. So still some clarity to take place, but it sounds like there is some, at least some guidelines.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we can garner from this is that most businesses that are operating as Schedule C businesses should consider forming either an S corporation or an LLC or a partnership, to make sure they can take advantage of this. And the reason I say that is because we have this wage and capital limitation. Typically, if you have a Schedule C, especially for a sole proprietorship, you may not have wages. So if you don't have wages and we have this wage and capital limitation that we're dealing with, you could lose the deduction entirely. But if you went into a partnership or an S corporation, one of these other types of entities, then we could still get the deduction. So the ones that are going to be really concerned are the ones that are sole proprietorships.
Okay. Good. That was a heavy subject right there.
It is. And I can tell you there's a lot of practitioners who are struggling with this still.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. All right. So I think both of our practices are somewhat diverse in the things that we do. One that I think we do, you know, somewhat in tandem would be succession planning for our clients. I know that's somewhat of a specialty of yours. Would you tell listeners what that means to you and how you approach succession planning?
Sure. I mean, succession planning, in a nutshell, is simple but complex. It's like an iceberg. One of the things that we want to do is be able to pass on the businesses that our clients have created either to their heirs, to their business partners, or to other individuals, maybe charitable organizations, as they see fit. We have to plan for that so that we can be efficient tax-wise and make sure that the actual results that we want and our goals are being met. So we do different things. We might do, for instance, a buy-sell agreement with an organization so that if there's a triggering event that causes a death, a divorce, a bankruptcy, there could be a whole host of different events that we specify in the agreement, that there would be a mechanism for that person that had that happen to them to be bought out. Mm-hmm. And we might decide we want to have appraisals to do it, or we might every year or two decide on a fixed value. And then we have to find a funding mechanism to make this all happen. The funding mechanism in a lot of circumstances is life insurance or maybe a loan. But life insurance is better for a lot of reasons. Yeah. One, it's a way to create money instantly. And it also is a way for the purchaser to create some basis in the entity that they're buying with using money that they receive tax-free. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the ways we do it. We also structure entities to encapsulate this. A lot of the LLCs that we write now have a lot of language like buy-sell agreements now. Mm-hmm. But the key element is to pass on these entities to the people that we want them to go to with the most tax-efficient method as we can.
So one of the things that we have done along those lines is people always talk about life, but what about disability? And so there's also comparable disability buyout policies that will work if it's determined someone's disabled and then they're not ever able to come back to work. So there is a set, fixed amount as opposed to a monthly benefit for life. The partners will get a fixed amount to buy the surviving but unable to work partner.
Correct. And that would be another example of a funding mechanism to make this happen. Yeah. And that could be a triggering event as well. If someone's disabled and they're not able to participate in the business anymore, it creates a hardship for the other partners. So this would be an excellent way to buy them out.
Great. Well, this is a great time. We're going to take a really quick break, and we'll be right back.
Imagine what it would feel like to lose everything. Your job, your home, your family, your dignity. This has happened to thousands of the men, women, veterans, and young adults we serve at Working Wardrobes. What do we do to help? We provide career development services, life skills workshops, job skills training. We provide the perfect interview outfit, and we get clients placed in jobs. Call Working Wardrobes, 714-210-2460. Donate, volunteer, invest. Higher.
When you use the Premier Rewards Gold Card from American Express, the rewards points can keep on multiplying. Buy 3 with triple points on airfare. Buy 2 with double points on gas and groceries. And a single point for pretty much every other dollar you spend on the card. Then, start choosing from over a million rewards to redeem all those points. Apply today and the annual fee for the first year is on us. Call 1-800-AXP-GOLD or visit axpgold.com. The annual fee for the card is $175. See terms, conditions, and restrictions at axpgold.com.
All right, back to Bart and his guest. I love how you perfectly triggered that commercial right before you talked about triggering events, right after. Yeah.
Oh, Paul, you're so clever. All right, so moving on to another subject, but still within the realm of our topic today. So, Dan, a situation that I come across quite often is parents or wealthy parents who have determined and targeted that their kids are going to receive their money or their estate or a great portion of it, but also concerned that the spouse or future ex-spouse of the children do not get the money. So, in other Correct. Words, their kids are protected. I know you do a lot of work in this area, so I want you to share about that.
Yeah, actually, the state bar did a survey to determine the one of the biggest concerns or the top couple of concerns that people had. And that question was number one.
Number one.
Number
wow.
one.
Okay.
So we get it quite a bit. When families come in for estate planning and they want to leave their wealth to their children, one of the big concerns that they have is, if I leave this to my son or daughter, how do I prevent the spouse that they're either currently married to or maybe married to in the future from leaving with these assets? And we do planning related to that. Sometimes what we'll do is we actually put requirements into the trust that makes the child, for instance, maybe do a prenuptial agreement that keeps these assets earmarked as separate property assets. And that's the key element to this question, is how do we keep something that's separate property without having it somehow transmute into being community property? Because if it's community property, it's something that in a divorce situation would be required to be shared with the wife, depending on how long they've been married. Especially in California, if we're married for over 10 years, then it's 50-50 at that point, and we have support issues for life. But one of the things we'll do is, for instance, if a child is bringing in assets to a marriage, we typically keep those assets in a separate property trust and designate them as such, and then we discuss having a prenuptial agreement with them as well, so that we don't somehow transmute this either through work or efforts towards that property into somehow community property. And we also get prenuptial or antinuptial agreements that we can do if there's an inheritance coming in. An inheritance will naturally be separate property okay. when it comes in, so will a gift, but we want to be able to maintain it that way. The only difference between the prenup and the anti-nuptial agreement is that an anti-nuptial agreement doesn't just naturally have consideration for it. Consideration for a prenuptial agreement is the actual marriage, but with an anti-nuptial agreement, we're going to have some sort of a payment or consideration okay. that is put together that makes it an effective agreement.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that whole subject of separate property is a little more complicated than most people know, right?
Absolutely. And some of the complications that come into it are maybe you have a couple that didn't even start with their lives in a community property state. Maybe they started in a state that
That's
was
right.
a separate property state, or maybe they were in a different state that had community property that treats yeah. community property differently. So one of the things that we do when we're doing this premarital planning or this planning to determine what we do with assets to keep them separately is we have to determine what they are. You know, is it separate property? Is what we call quasi-community property that maybe wasn't community property originally, but somehow California treats it such, or it's actually community property? And then once we know the three different classifications of the property, then we can start working with it to see, you know, what we want to maintain and how we want to use that property yeah. going forward.
Yeah, so complicated. I'd highly recommend someone reach out to you or someone like you to get that help with that if that's an issue that they're going to run into.
Absolutely. It isn't something you want to do on your own. And in fact, to have something that's valid, you typically have to have both spouses have counsel, and they have to be different. I could represent one of the spouses, but
yeah.
somebody else would have to represent the other one.
Okay, gotcha. All right. So another area that we do somewhat in common is in the area of divorce. I, in addition to a CFP, I'm also a CDFA, Certified Divorce Financial Analyst, and I know you do some divorce planning work also, or more pre-divorce planning, correct?
Both. I do pre-divorce planning, and I also do post-divorce planning. I've functioned as an expert witness in numerous family law cases and divorces.
Yeah. Okay, good to know. All right, we've got time for one more, and this one is very timely. This actually came up just today, Dan. I had a client situation come up, and I'm going to make a long story short. So I know you know a little bit about annuities. So a client in the year 2000, before she was my client, she had an annuity for before then even, and she was going to do a 1035 exchange, which is what we know is you're going to transfer the cash value from one product to another and forego the taxes like you would a 1031 exchange with a real estate. So unbeknownst to her, unbeknownst to anyone until what we just found out today, the original annuity was qualified, meaning it was pre-tax like an IRA. The new annuity was non-qualified. Nothing was triggered then, nothing that we're aware of. Fast forward now 16 years, because the event happened in 2016. She became my client sometime around 2010. She had, the annuity had changed hands a few times, changed carriers, at which often happens. One carrier buys another. It's what's known as a variable annuity, so it's basically stock market or mutual fund exposure. Upon review year after year, I realized that this annuity was not making any money. Matter of fact, she was actually losing money in annuity in a market that was gaining money at the time. So my recommendation at the time was, look, you have your basis, you're at a loss, so you're below basis. There's nothing that prevents you from taking the money out of a non-qualified annuity. Taking the money out, let's put it in your trust account. Let's manage it at a less expensive ratio and try to get you some growth. Great, great. That was 2016. It's now 2018. She got a notification last week from the IRS saying that she it was a $69,000 annuity, that she owes taxes on a $69,000 annuity withdrawal. We scratched her head. This is a non-qualified. This was below basis. What's going on? Well, research, my assistant called and called and worked her way through to find out that in the year 2000, what I just shared with you, it was actually started out as a qualified to a non-qualified. I know we only have a moment here. What would your advice be to my client? And the great thing about this is I'm going to get some advice. I don't have to pay your hourly rate here for the next 2 minutes.
Another great question, Bart. I think that the first thing we do in a situation like this is we have to get a hold of the correspondence file from the IRS to see exactly what statutes or law they're quoting and why they believe that this money's due. And then we analyze that, determine if this is in fact something that would be due. Then we have to look at the various statutes of limitation. One that would concern me in this case is the 10-year collection statute that says that from the time the tax is assessed, they only have 10 years to collect it. They're trying to assess the tax now, that may be inappropriate. So those types of issues need to be reviewed closely,
okay,
and determine what has actually happened here to see if your client basically what I'd call has a leg to stand,
yeah,
on, and we have an arguable position that we can take that would either lead to a favorable settlement with the IRS,
yeah,
or maybe not paying anything,
yeah,
at all.
Great. Well, expect a call. We'll talk offline.
All right. Appreciate it.
All right, so we have run out of time. Dan, it's been a pleasure having you in the studio with me today. I now have the honor of asking the final thought question, and that is, please share with us your ultimate lesson learned over your tenure as a legal professional.
Well, this is why I think I'm going to mention this one. I had an individual call me on the phone about a week ago, and he had not talked to me in 20 years, and he said, you know what, you said something to me 20 years ago that I still remember to this day, and everywhere I go, I tell everybody, and it's just stuck with me forever. And he said, I go, what is that? Because
yeah,
I'm dying to know.
I'd love to know.
He said, it's not what you make, it's what you keep.
That's a great one, Dan. That's a real good one. All right, Dan. Hey, what's your guilty pleasure?
Guilty pleasure? I play guitar a lot.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Learned something about you today. Excellent. All right, Dan, thanks again for joining us in the studio today. And for those who want to learn more about Dan and what he does, you can visit him at www.ustaxrescue.com. Do I need to spell that out, Paul, or is that pretty good?
Nah, I think you got that.
Thanks so much to everyone who has tuned in, and we look forward to having you back in studio next week. Cheers.
Right, thanks for having me.
Tune in next week for the latest edition of the Zandbergen Report, Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Catch up on our recent shows by visiting www.bartzandbergen.com. Interested in being a featured guest on our show or have a question you'd like to hear us answer on the Zandbergen Report? Email podcast@bartzandbergen.com.